Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for an hour from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. Looking forward to talking with you and having you talk with me. That is, this is a live program that's a call-in, it's a caller-driven program, and we open the phone lines for you to call in if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or if you have an alternate viewpoint, would like to bring that up for discussion, as we sometimes do, including yesterday we had a lively discussion from a caller who disagreed. You're always welcome to call and to disagree if you'd like. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. We're going to talk first of all to Marty from Port Orchard, Washington, right now. Hello, Marty. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thank you. I got a quick question, and that is, can you explain the difference between witnessing and testifying? And I'd take the answer off here, if I may.
All right. Thanks for your call, Marty. Actually, in the Greek, in the New Testament, the word witness and testimony are the same word in the Greek. And actually, it's the word that came to mean martyr. It's martia. And although it didn't mean, in biblical times, the Greek word didn't mean somebody who died for their faith, but it just meant someone who bore testimony or gave witness. Eventually, the word evolved into a reference to people who died for their witness or died for their faith. So martia, which became martyr in later meaning, it just meant a witness or a testimony or one who testified. And so those are the same idea. Just as it would be in a courtroom of law today, if a person is put on the witness stand, it's so that they might bear testimony. A witness is a testimony, and that means that somebody has seen something and knows something to be true, and they repeat it, they report it as such. Now, in the New Testament, the people who are said to have borne witness or testimony were the apostles, because the apostles were chosen by Christ to bear testimony of his resurrection. That's what they said in chapter 6 of Acts. That's what we find going on in the apostles' ministry. They're testifying to the resurrection of Christ. Why? Because they were like witnesses to an event, like witnesses to a crime, who've seen something happen, and they can tell what they saw. They saw Christ after he was raised from the dead, so they could bear witness of that. And that's what witness means most of the time in the New Testament. Now, sometimes the witness of the church or the witness of John in Revelation chapter 1 is, a reference to preaching the gospel or bearing witness to the gospel. You'll find the word witness used very frequently in the book of Revelation, and it includes the witness of Jesus, the witness of John, the writer, the witness of the saints who are persecuted by Satan, who overcome him by the word of their testimony, their witness, the two witnesses who bear their testimony for a period of time. And throughout the book of Revelation, you'll find frequent reference to the idea of witness or testimony. But it has a more general use there of simply sharing the gospel, testifying to what is true about Jesus and the gospel in general. Now, you may be thinking of witness and testimony in the sense that people often use them in the modern church, and those words have morphed a little bit in evangelical usage. Sometimes when we are sharing the gospel with an unbeliever, we call that witnessing. At least I grew up calling it that in the church I went to. We call that going out to witness to people. And that meant to go out and share the gospel with them. It might involve giving them a tract, trying to strike up a conversation about where they stand, and making sure we try to get across the facts of the gospel. Witnessing to people, therefore, just came to be, in modern speech, a synonym for just sharing the gospel with people. Though giving your testimony in modern evangelical parlance usually means something like sharing how you got saved, telling about what happened to you to lead you up to accepting Christ and then what he did for you since then. Of course, people can give a testimony about something more contemporary than that, that they feel that God has done for them. But in modern Christian speech, giving a testimony usually means you're telling about something in your own experience that God has done. Very frequently, it's how you got saved. Witnessing has come to have a different meaning in again, the popular parlance, and that is to share the gospel with people, soul winning, as some people would call it. Now, those words, in other words, usually have a different meaning in the way they are used today, but in the Bible they would be the same thing. Now, there's something entirely different in the Bible besides testimony and witnesses, and that is evangelism. In the Bible says God gave some evangelists, and evangelism is proclaiming the gospel, or, you know, being one who brings the gospel to people. And that's another thing altogether. But we would kind of mix a lot of those things up. If you have a conversation with an unbeliever, and in that conversation you tell something about how you got saved, you present the gospel, and, you know, you make an appeal to them to come to Christ, we would call that all the above. We would call that witnessing, testifying, preaching the gospel. Those terms have slightly different meanings in the Bible in some cases. Not evangelism so much. Evangelism's probably got the same meaning today as it did then. But witness and testify, those are different today for the most part, because they, in the Bible, both those words spoke of bearing testimony, like a person in a court of law would bear testimony to something they'd seen. And that was generally the work of the apostles in the early days of the church, at least. All right, well, I appreciate your call, and our lines are open right now. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. A week or two ago, I received an email from, it looks like, the name is Eileen. It actually looks like the name Eileen without an N. So I don't know if the writer's name is Eileen and mistyped it, or if her name is Eileen. But in any case, she wrote this question. She says, "Hi, Steve. I have a friend who is struggling with raising three small children who are very close together in age. Her husband might be considered a workaholic and is not present in the home. He feels convicted that using birth control is a sin, while she cannot handle having another child at this time. They are in conflict over this. I would like to ask, is it wrong to use birth control? Is it okay to limit the number of children in your family based on what you think you can handle and how much help you can get from your spouse?" She said that she feels she is strained with three children and cannot be as good a mother as she was to two children, losing her temper more, for example. Therefore, she doesn't think having another would be a good idea for everyone in the family because she possibly couldn't be a good mother. I respect your opinion and would like to hear your take on this subject if you have the time." Well, this question is difficult to answer briefly for the simple reason that the Bible does not anywhere actually forbid the use of birth control. And the use of birth control, therefore, could not be said in itself to be a sin. And there might be people who use birth control who are not sinning thereby. But, of course, in the Christian way of looking at things, it's not always the thing itself, but the motives for doing a thing that make it right or wrong. If you, for example, the Bible says, whatever is not of faith is sin. If you don't feel that you can trust God about your family size, then, and therefore use birth control, it may possibly be that this would be overstepping into a realm where you're doing something that's not of faith. If it's that you don't value children and you value something more than them, for example, money, which you would have to spend more if you had more children, or your privacy or something like that. That is, if you had some selfish reason for not wanting children and use birth control, that too could be a sinful motive. Especially if God wanted to give you children, you say, "No, I'd rather not. I think I want to have my life to myself." And this is, of course, forgetting that our bodies are not our own. We've been bought with a price. We belong to God. And if he wants to give us children, then we should welcome that. That's a use of our bodies. That's a very, frankly, that's the original use of the human body. When God made man and woman, the only thing he told them to do is have kids. And so that's what he made human bodies, especially he made marriage and sexual differences between men and women for, because he wanted there to be children. That doesn't mean that it would always be wrong to limit the number of children you have or to space them necessarily, but it could be wrong if your motivations are not good. See, the Christian should always be searching their own heart to know whether what they're doing is good or bad. There's lots of things that are gray areas, which some Christians think are wrong and some think are right, and the Bible is silent about. And those are areas where I think no one can judge another person, although a person ought to judge themselves. They ought to judge their own motives and say, is this for godly reasons or is this for selfish reasons that I'm making whatever decision I'm making? And this would be the thing I would encourage people to think about when they are considering birth control. Now, in the case of this woman you're talking about, there's an irony in this. The husband thinks it's wrong to use birth control, but apparently he doesn't think it's wrong to neglect his children and to not play a role in their growth. I personally think that an ideal family, where the husband is involved as he should be and the wife is involved as she should be, would ideally allow God to bring as many children into the family as possible and so forth. And we could have, you know, there's a lot of ideals the Bible gives. But when you compromise on one of them, sometimes it throws the other ones out of whack. And so the man who should be involved in the rearing of his children with his wife, the man who should be there for them more, but is gone most of the time, he's neglecting something that I think the Bible teaches about family life. But he's holding firmly to another thing that isn't taught as clearly in the Bible, and that is the avoidance of birth control. So what he's doing is he's taking a part of his family obligation seriously as he understands it, but he's not the other. Now, since I haven't heard from the man, I may give him the benefit of the doubt that by being what you call a workaholic, he may feel like he's just providing for his family and see that's what his obligation is. But if he's not aware that his wife is overwhelmed, that she's not able to take care of the children by herself, and he's not there to do it, he should realize that providing for your family means more than providing money for your family. You need to provide some kind of spiritual guidance and structure and discipline and order in the family. And the mother, of course, there are single mothers who manage to do that somehow, but it's extremely difficult. So my thought is that if they did not use birth control, they're not necessarily sinning, especially if the wife, I would say this, if the husband felt that they should use it, and the wife felt she didn't want to, I don't think there's anything wrong with the husband accommodating his wife in this. Although some would disagree with me. Because you have to realize that birth control really doesn't always control birth. No matter what kind of birth control you use, you can still get pregnant. And unless you've, you know, had a hysterectomy or something like that or something, you know. But I even heard a story on the radio many years ago about a man who had a vasectomy and his wife had her tubes tied and they still got pregnant. And they beat the odds. I think it was like a 5 million to 1 odds that would happen, but it happened anyway. So God is able to get past those things if he wants to give you a baby in spite of using birth control. And therefore, I don't know that using birth control really makes an awful lot of sense. I personally believe that God is sovereign over the giving of babies. And I think the creation of a baby is God's work. And even though we participate in it biologically, I think God is one who decides whether to give a baby or not. For example, I was married for 20 years to a woman who we wanted to have as many children as possible. We had 4. And we're not able to have any more after that. So it's very clear that God is the one who gives children. We don't decide. But if the woman wishes to address the situation, I think the husband should be sensitive to her needs. At the same time, I think that she might take this as an opportunity to test her own faith and say, well, if my husband simply, cannot be brought to agree about this, maybe God would have me Just trust him in this matter. God can keep me from getting pregnant if he wants to. And, you know, she could take that approach too. All I'm saying is I'm not going to meddle in the lives of these people. I personally think there's some things out of whack in that marriage and maybe a blind spot on the part of the guy. But someone should speak to him about that, because if his wife is overwhelmed with the number of children they have and yet he wants more, he's going to be responsible for, you know, fixing that, I think, before God. He needs to fix his own behavior, and there might be cases where he'd have to be, you know, so sensitive to his wife that even though he'd rather not use birth control, he'd go ahead and allow it. I want to say this, though, that when I say birth control, that's a broad subject. One good form of birth control is abstinence. And even in marriage, people can go, you know, a week or so if they need to, or more, if they want to make sure they avoid pregnancy. That's one form of birth control. And I can't think of anything that's necessarily biblically against it. On the other hand, most pills, birth control pills, are abortifacient, and therefore they don't really prevent conception. They just prevent a conceived baby from surviving if it's conceived. And therefore they're basically a form of chemical abortion, at least in a certain percentage of cases. So I would think that Christians who don't believe in abortion, as I certainly don't, would avoid the pill at all costs. There are other options. Anyway, Eileen, I don't know if the woman you're talking about is yourself or a friend of yours, but those are my thoughts on the situation. I don't have a black and white answer, because I don't think the Bible speaks directly about the sinfulness of using birth control. But it does speak about a husband's responsibility to order his household properly, and I think that that may be what's not happening in that particular situation. Let's talk to Jonah. Boy, I was just about to hit someone else's line, and they disappeared. Jonah from Monterey, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve, for taking my call. First, I would like to wish you a very blessed year.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have two questions, actually. First one is about when the Lord appeared to Mary, and then he told her not to touch him because he's going to the Father. But then we see that he's talking to Thomas. He appeared to Thomas. I don't know whether... Does the Bible say anything that he touched him?
Well, Jesus invited him to touch him. Jesus said, here, put your finger in the holes of my hands, because he knew that Thomas...
But he didn't.
Well, we don't read that he did or that he didn't. But we do read elsewhere. We do read elsewhere about people touching him. For example, I think it's in Matthew when the women... who had encountered the angel at the empty tomb were on their way to inform the disciples, as the angels told them to. They encountered Jesus, and they grabbed his feet. And let me see if I can find that particular
place. This was after the resurrection?
Yeah, this is after the resurrection. Yeah, Matthew 28:9. And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, rejoice. And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. So he didn't forbid them to touch him on that occasion.
So why he told Mary that?
Well, I believe we have to recognize what is implied by his statement, do not touch me. The King James says, touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. And other translations sometimes say, do not touch me. The word touch, the Greek word there is hapto, H-A-P-T-O, hapto. And it really, it can mean touch, but it is also the same word that would mean to cling to something. And therefore, many modern translations translate Jesus' words, don't cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. And if that's his meaning, which makes perfectly good sense, then we could sort of reconstruct the situation this way. Mary, upon losing Jesus when he died, felt like she'd lost, of course, the person dearest to her and was very much bereaved. But when she found him alive again, she no doubt grabbed him and said, you know, she may have said nothing, but what was in her heart was, oh, well, I thought I'd lost you, but you're back. I'm never going to let go of you again. And she needed to realize he's not back to stay. He's back for a little while, then he's going to go into heaven and be gone. And so I think what he's telling her is, don't cling to me, because I still have to go away again. I have yet to go to my father, which he did, of course, 40 days later when he ascended into heaven. And I think that would probably be the meaning of his words to Mary.
Okay. Okay, the other question is, you mentioned before that St. Augustine was a Manichaean before he came to the faith.
Yes.
However, I did some digging on that, but it showed that he was just a listener, not a actual Manichaean. So could you please provide me the source or the book?
Well, he was a pagan.
One of them?
He was a pagan, and he was a philosopher, and he was, I don't know to what degree he taught Manichaeanism, but he... All the church historians I've ever read said that he was a Manichaean in his beliefs. Manichaeanism was a form of Gnosticism that was sort of an alternative to Christianity in the early days of the church. And it was something that was very popular among many philosophers, and Augustine among them. Now, when I say he was a Manichaean, I don't know that I would want to say that he joined a Manichaean organization. It's like if somebody was having the Jehovah's Witnesses over on a regular basis at their home, mm-hmm. and studying the Bible with them and not objecting to it and buying what they were saying, even if that person never joined the Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall, if their beliefs came to coincide with those of the Jehovah's Witnesses, I would have no problem calling them Jehovah's Witnesses, although maybe technically they haven't joined the cult. I don't know to what degree Augustine joined any Manichaean organization, but he was apparently very sympathetic toward that.
Alrighty. Thank you so much. God bless.
Okay, Jonah. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. All right, once again, our lines are open. They were all full not too very long ago, but some of our callers were not able to wait, and they hung up, and so we now have our lines all empty once more. So if you'd like to be on the program, feel free to give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. My friend Dwayne has an announcement for you, and I'll be right back to take your calls.
Can you have whatever you say? Can you write your own ticket with God? Is health and prosperity only a positive confession away? Is it an evidence of weak faith to be poor or sick? If these questions do not sound familiar, then you have not encountered the widely taught Word of Faith teaching. This is a doctrine of health and wealth, name it and claim it, and positive confession promoted by many of the world's largest churches and televangelists. While claiming to take their views from the Bible, the Word of Faith teachers actually promote doctrines distinctive of the metaphysical mind science cults. Because they are false, these teachings constitute an affront to the character of God and have done great harm to many who have embraced them. In a four-lecture series entitled, An Examination of the Word of Faith Teachings, Steve Gregg has thoroughly explored and refuted these claims from Scripture. An Examination of the Word of Faith Teachings, a four-lecture series, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from our website, www.thenarrowpath.com. There is no charge for anything at our website. Visit us there and be amazed at all that you have been missing. That web address again is www.thenarrowpath.com.
All right, welcome back to The Narrow Path. And my name is Steve Gregg, and we're live, so that if that would be, I guess it's the 3rd of January, 2013. I got to get used to saying that. So if you'd like to join us live here on the program, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Tom, calling from Portland, Oregon. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hello, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got on so fast. Wow.
Yeah, that was quick, wasn't it?
Hey, I'm one of your local or regular callers, but I'm in Portland, Oregon today on a business trip, and I have a question for you. I mean, I have knowledge on this myself, as most believers do, but it still at times puzzles me, and that's the omnipresence of God, meaning that he's everywhere at the same time in the universe as well as on the earth. And, you know, sometimes I, for lack of a better word, trip on this, and That's a 60s term, by the way.
Yes, I was there.
I just sort of like, yeah. Well, you know what they say about the 60s, brother? If you can remember it, you were never there.
Yeah, so anyway, that's right.
but the thing is that what amazes me, and I accept it by faith, is how he's able to hear a million, billion different prayers all at the same time, yet give equal undivided attention to each person at that same time, same moment. And it just fries my mind. I was wondering if you could just expound on this and explain this concept, because it's a very key part of the Christian faith, but at the same time, it's one of the most difficult to grasp. And that's my question.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Are you listening on the radio?
I shut it off.
Oh, okay. Do you want to stay on the line then? That's fine. I just want to...
I'll click off. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. The only reason I asked that is because there's some noise on the line, so I was going to suggest if you could listen on the radio, we wouldn't have the noise on the line. This idea of God hearing everybody's prayers at one moment has been wrestled with by Christian philosophers, and you may be aware, or if not, you may like to become aware, that C.S. Lewis had a whole chapter on that subject in his book Mere Christianity. Now, I'm not sure that he's correct or is not correct, but the view he takes is one that many Christians do take, and the Bible does not refute it. The Bible doesn't teach it either, but it's not refuted in the Bible. So here, this is just a Christian philosophical answer, which may or may not be correct. But C.S. Lewis believed that God lives outside of time. Many Christians repeat that statement as if it's taught in the Bible. The Bible doesn't ever say anything like that. But nonetheless, there are those who believe that eternity is a realm that is outside the realm of time, and that time is a created thing. But eternity, of course, is where God lives, and God's eternal. So eternity is, of course, eternity, and it's timeless. Some people talk about this as God living in the eternal now. One way that C.S. Lewis described it was that if you picture all of time as drawn on a piece of paper, a line drawn from one point to another representing all of time, God or eternity would be the whole piece of paper. And the idea, he said, was that God can look at any point of time at any given time. He can look at the past, the present, or the future instantly and for as long as he wishes without ever interacting with that passage of time. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. It's a very common thing for Christians to say. It's a philosophical thing to say. And I don't even know if there is such a thing as eternity outside of time, or whether time is simply or whether eternity is just time stretched out infinitely long. That's something for the philosophers, because the Bible doesn't really describe or teach anything about that. But according to C.S. Lewis, because God's outside of time, it's as if he's in sort of a different time frame. And he gave the example of how an author who's writing a book is telling a novel, is telling a story, and the story has its own time frame. The characters in the story are experiencing things in a certain chronology that is, distinctive to the story. The author himself is not part of the story and is not in that time frame. So the author has his own time frame that transcends the time frame of the characters in the novel that is being written. And C.S. Lewis was saying that an author could write, a line like this. Mary put down the pencil. Suddenly there was a knock at the door. Now, C.S. Lewis said the author could spend days or weeks deciding what the next line is going to be. Like, what's going to happen when Mary goes to the door? Well, the author has all the time in the world to consider that. But once he writes the next line, then no time has passed for Mary. That is, Mary hears the knock at the door, and next thing she, in her world, she gets up and she goes and answers the door, and something else happens. But in the author's time, it could have been hours or weeks between the knock on the door and Mary getting up, because he's not in the same time frame as Mary is. Now, Lewis gave that as an example to explain how God could give attention to everybody's prayers. He says, when we talk about how can God hear everyone's prayers at the same time, he says the bugaboo there is the expression at the same time. If God is not in time, then he can give an infinite amount of attention to every event of a split second. And he could, you know, as it were, just like the author in his own experience can, as it were, halt the time of the novel he's writing in order to consider something a long time. God there's no such thing as time in that sense for God. And he can give all the attention he wants to every prayer that anyone prays at any given moment in their own time. This is heady stuff, and it's Lewis, of course, puts it much more. He brings it down to the simpler level of illustration. Some philosophers would say it much more profoundly, and I'm not sure they're right, but I'm not sure they're wrong either. This may answer the question. The other part of the answer that I would give is that God simply is, by Christian theology, infinite. In many ways, he's infinitely powerful, he's infinitely wise, infinitely knowing, infinitely enduring, infinitely present at all places and all times. And so whether he's outside of time or not, for there to be 6 billion prayers being offered up to him at the same moment may not be overwhelming to him. For me to have two children asking me different things at the same moment, I have to make one of them stop talking so I can listen to the other one. Although some women who can multitask could hear both of them and probably give thought to both of what they're saying. But men and women are not infinite. God is. He's infinite in his qualities and in his competence. And therefore, it's not hard for me to believe that someone with infinite attributes like God could take on what would seem an infinite number of messages coming to him simultaneously. If I were doing so, I'd be harried. You know, I think of a telephone switchboard operator, you know, trying to take all the calls and plugging in one at a time in the old days. I'm sure they don't do that anymore. But the idea is that, you know, a telephone operator could be harried by having too many calls coming in at the same time. God would be able to take them all. And how he can do that, we don't know. It's perhaps true what C.S. Lewis said, which would be one way of looking at it, which would be another way of saying we don't understand it. Because although C.S. Lewis described it in a way that might make sense to us, it still means there's something going on that we just cannot fathom. It's outside of our ken and outside of our experience. But that would be true no matter how we explain God being everywhere and knowing everything and hearing everything and responding to everyone. All we can say is that the God of the Bible is infinite. Either he exists or he doesn't. If he doesn't exist, then, of course, he can't hear any prayers. If he does exist, he can hear as many as there are offered to him. And I think that may not be satisfying to someone who wants to nail everything else down. But I think that's where we have to stand on at least the limited information that the Bible gives us on it. I appreciate your call, Tom. And let's talk to Ken from Albany, Oregon next.
Well, I think that's where...
Hey, Ken?
Are
you going to turn your radio down?
I appreciate your call, Tom.
Okay, Ken. This is a strange thing. What's happening is Ken's listening to the radio. Ken, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yeah. Let me just say for your benefit and that of everybody else, you can't listen to the radio and me at the same time on the phone because there's a time lag. Maybe 30 seconds or more. So when I call your name on the phone, you won't hear it on the radio till maybe 30 seconds later, which means that the audience has to listen to me calling your name for 30 seconds, and that doesn't work out real well. So not just Ken, but anybody, if you put on hold and you want to talk, hold the phone to your ear and don't count on the radio to tell you when I'm calling you because you won't hear it when it's time. Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, I wondered if current events that make you reconsider eschatology, say the events in Israel, Iran, and the Russia treaty.
You wonder if something that's going on in Israel would make me reconsider my eschatology?
Yeah.
Well,
current events?
No, because, see, I don't base my eschatology on current events. I base it on what the Bible says. Now, people who follow what we sometimes call newspaper exegesis, they change their eschatology all the time by current events, which means that their eschatology doesn't... their eschatology is not... I don't think we can both talk at the same time. Are you still listening to the radio or the phone? We need to talk.
I'm on the phone. There might be an echo because I'm on a cell phone or something.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that if a person's eschatology changes with current events, that means their theology is based in current events, not in the Bible, because the Bible doesn't change. So my eschatological view is based on how I read the Bible.
Yeah, well, how I read it, you know, Ezekiel 38 and 39, those conflicts could be masked with what's going on in the world today, don't you think?
Well, I don't think it's true, but I understand your position because I held it myself and taught it for many years. Yeah, I know that the way that dispensationalists read Ezekiel 38 and 39, they would see that as having something to do with Russia and the Middle East. I don't read it that way because I don't think there's any real good reason to do so, but I certainly understand why some people do, because I used to do it myself.
Well, I'm open to other views, but I just wondered, you know, the way things are going in the world today, the way the focus is on the Middle East, that, you know, the Tim LaHaye, Hal Lindsey view, it makes you wonder.
Yeah, well, it does. It does make you wonder, but I would say this, that although we can find many things going on in the world, including the Middle East, that could be fit into some kind of prophetic paradigm that we come up with, Christians have been able to do that with their current events for the last 2,000 years. I would say from the time of the apostles until now, there have been Christians who are looking at their own times and saying, look, the things are happening that the Bible said were going to happen. Therefore, Jesus is coming soon. In fact, Paul actually had to write to people in his day in 2 Thessalonians 2 and tell them that's not true. There are other things that have to happen too. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you certainly have a lot of Christians on your side in this matter.
Yeah. Well, I just study it a lot and just wanted to hear your opinion.
All right, Ken. Yeah, if you call almost any other pastor or something, they'll probably tell you something different than what I said.
Of course. All right, thanks a lot.
All right, God bless you, Ken. Bye now.
Bless you.
I say almost any other. There are some other amillennial Christian talk show hosts out there, but most pastors that you talk to probably are going to be dispensational and agree with what you were suggesting. Brad from Kuski, Idaho is next. Brad, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
You know, he brought up Ezekiel 38 and 39.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard, sounds pretty good to me when I've read it, that it is fulfilled in the book of Esther?
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that.
Have you studied that at all?
Well, I could study it more than I have, but I've considered it. I've heard arguments for it. I think it could be true. I think that's Gary DeMar's view, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah,
I heard it from James Jordan, actually.
Oh, okay, yeah, James Jordan and Gary DeMar are friends. Yeah, I think that's... I think that's a possibility. Another view, of course, is that it's talking about the Maccabean Wars. And now, of course, anyone out there listening to us who's never heard any view except the view that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is about Russia coming in the last days down to Israel, they're going to be kind of thrown for a loop by either of those two suggestions, because obviously there are things described in those chapters that did not literally occur. For example, fire and brimstone didn't come down from heaven and consume the bad guys in the story of Esther or in the Maccabean War. They didn't bury the bodies for 7 months, and they didn't burn the weapons for 7 years. And those kinds of facts would make people say, well, then that didn't happen then, so it must be something future. But as you know, Brad, I'm talking kind of over your shoulder to the people out there listening to us, Ezekiel uses great symbolic imagery, and it's not at all impossible to see the imagery of Ezekiel 38 and 39 if we take it with the same way of understanding his imagery that we take the rest of his prophecies. It's not hard to apply them to something like the Maccabean Wars or to the story of Esther. Both of those events certainly happened in the right time period, because the chapter 38 comes right after chapter 37, and chapter 37 discusses God bringing the Jews back from the exile in Babylon back to their own land, and chapter 38 then picks up from there. So sometime after the return of the exiles from Babylon is the time setting for Ezekiel 38 and 39, and that could be Esther's time, or it could be just a little later. It could be the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the Maccabean revolt. I'm not sure which it is, but I think the idea of it being the story of Esther has merit.
I was impressed, but it was a couple years ago when I was listening to it via MP3 by James Jordan.
Uh-huh.
He was able to tie in those first things you mentioned, like the 7 months to bury and stuff, in pretty well with not history, but with symbols.
Symbolism, like, yeah, right.
And
exactly.
I've now forgotten, you know, how he did it, but I have to go back and re-listen. But at the time, it sounded very believable.
Like yourself, I haven't read anything recently on it, and it's a long time ago I first heard the theory, and I heard some arguments for it that made some sense. So, I mean, it's been in my mind as one of the possibilities ever since then.
Okay. Well, I've been wanting to ask you about that for a couple of years, and I finally remembered to do it. Okay.
Well, this was a good occasion for it, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. See you.
Okay, Brad, God bless you.
You too.
Good talking to you. All right, Dan from Corvallis, Oregon is next. Hi, Dan. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Hey, just a quick recommendation for you that I was reminded by the call from Ken there. I'm talking about current events, and a book I read this year is called Father of Faith Missions, The Life and Times of Anthony Norris Groves.
I've got it, and I've read most of it. It's a great book.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I was really struck by his experience in Baghdad, and I thought if ever somebody could think that the Lord was returning tomorrow, today, that guy there would have been the one. Anyhow, which is of course very interesting in his relationship with the father of dispensationalism.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, and our listeners probably don't know who Anthony Norris Groves was. He's not a very well-known person, but he's the one who was the inspiration for people like George Mueller and Hudson Taylor. Actually, right. George Mueller was married to Anthony Norris Groves' sister, Mary Groves. But he had, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was even before he married her that he encountered
right.
or read about Anthony Norris Groves and was inspired by his living by faith. Groves was a dentist, wasn't he, as I recall?
Yes.
And
yes.
He gave up his practice in England to go to overseas as a missionary, and he was one of the first in modern times to actually take a stand of not letting anyone know his needs and just trusting God for everything. And that inspired George Mueller, that inspired Hudson Taylor, and later on people like Rhys Howells and others who became more famous than him. Actually, Groves is not that well known, but he was a great man.
Yeah, it was a fascinating book in many, many respects. So just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I appreciate that, Dan. And if I hadn't heard of the book, I'd be very glad you told me about it because I'd want to get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Steve.
God bless you. Bye now.
Yep.
Okay, our phone lines are sluggish today, which means it's a great opportunity for those who've always wanted to get through but feel like can't get through because they're too busy. Some days they're very busy. For some reason, today is a slow day, and our lines are open. However, we only have about 10 minutes left, so if you want to get through, do not delay. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I received another email not very long ago from someone who remained anonymous, and he said, Steve, I've recently taken up smoking again after quitting for 7 years. I feel like an idiot for doing this, and I have no good explanation for why I've done this. The urge to smoke is powerful, and I hate it at the same time. Can you offer some advice? Well, I don't know. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, although I have friends and relatives who've had trouble giving up smoking. One couple I know, when they got saved, came to our school, and they'd been smoking 2 packs a day almost all their whole lives, and they were about 30 at the time. Maybe they're 40. They were 40 at the time. And they decided to give up smoking, and it took them all. It was really hard. They were not successful for a while, but they kept determining to do so. I remember them going through long fasts and prayers and things like that, and they still had struggles. But eventually they beat it, As I recall, I think it took them a couple of years. And some persistent habits take that long. God can give you the grace and God can give you the victory. He can do that instantly, but he doesn't always. Sometimes I think he wants to teach your hands to war. He wants to teach you how to make spiritual battle, how to bring discipline into your life and so forth. And the frustration of not being able to quit smoking quickly might be one of those things God's using. But I believe that as you continue, first of all, I don't believe that smoking is going to send anyone to hell. So it's not like you're going to go to hell because you're smoking, but you probably don't like smoking because it's a bad testimony. It's expensive. It doesn't glorify God. It's not healthy. There's all kinds of good reasons to not smoke. And I believe that, if you're desiring God's help and praying and continuing to fight it, you should not let yourself get too frustrated that you fall, but you should ask God to help you to walk in the Spirit and not fulfill the lusts of your flesh. And I'm not saying there's an instant victory in that, but I would say there's momentary victories. And momentary victories sometimes become prolonged victories, and prolonged victories sometimes become permanent victories. In any case, it's kind of strange after being off cigarettes for 7 years that you picked it up again. I've seen that done too, and I don't understand why people would do it, but then everybody's got some weakness or another, and smoking isn't one of mine, but I certainly have my own too. And I would say that all of us, as we seek to live a godly life and be a good testimony for Christ and be good stewards of what he's given us, we have something in our lives that we generally have to work on because we're not perfect yet. And smoking is your demon right now. And I don't mean demon in the literal sense here, but it's the thing that it's your battle. But every one of us has a battle. And I would just say, keep battling, cultivate your walk with God, pray, continually ask for deliverance. When you fall, just ask God to give you more strength next time. Don't get too frustrated. The devil would like to use that to frustrate you so you'd give up hope. Don't ever give up hope, because the victory might be just around the corner for all any of us know at any given time. We're going to talk to Matt from Salinas next. Matt, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yes, could you tell me more about Lilith? I heard she was the first woman here on earth, and it was never put in the Bible. Could you explain more about Lilith?
Well, Lilith never existed. Lilith is a figment of a Jewish mythology. She was thought to be Adam's first wife, and that Eve was his second wife. And according to Jewish mythology, I believe that she was banished and went out to live in the deserts. And so, she was kind of she's viewed as sort of a demon woman or something like that. I don't remember the details. I read about Lilith many years ago, and there was something she did that made her be banished. And she's not considered to be just a normal woman in the mythology. I think she's more like an evil goddess or a demonic woman of some kind. But I would just say, if you're interested in that, which I'm not very much, and that's why I don't know more about it. If you're interested, just go online, Google Lilith, Lilith, and you'll find out the story.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. Good talking to you. All right. Vince from Las Vegas, Nevada is next. Vince, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you, Steve, and thank you for your ministry.
Sure.
It said in the Bible when Jesus arose from the grave, a number of saints arose with him. We're not told a lot about this, but in your opinion, would you see them as having their resurrection bodies also along with Christ?
I don't think so. You're referring to Matthew 28.
I'm sorry. My Bible.
Or 27. Yeah, it's Matthew 27, verse 51 and following. It says, "Behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of their graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many." What I think is that the word saints here needs to be considered to just mean holy people, and I believe they were holy people who had lived and died recently. They're coming back to life, in my opinion, was like Lazarus coming back to life, or Jairus' daughter coming back to life. They had died not very long ago, had not decomposed, and were probably brought back to life simply by being resuscitated by God. As opposed to, let's say, the bodies of people who had decomposed and they were mere dust, to suggest that God recreated these saints out of the dust would suggest an actual resurrection, like the resurrection of the last day. And the reason I don't think that happened, because Paul, when he's talking about the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15, he said, you know, in Christ all shall be made alive. He said, but everyone is in his own order. Christ the first fruits, and after him, those who are his at his coming. So I believe that Paul says, okay, Christ is the only one so far who's been glorified in resurrection. But and the next will be us at his coming. So I don't think that these people were glorified. And for them to come back together from the dust, if they were like people who died hundreds of years earlier or even decades earlier, they'd have to be reconstituted from almost the basic elements. And I don't think there's any suggestion necessarily that that's the case. I think it's more like people who had died not so very long ago, whose bodies were not yet decomposed, but were godly people, and they rose, sort of like Lazarus rose or Jairus' daughter. It was a sign to those in Jerusalem when they saw these people come back to life again. And they were recognized, which they wouldn't have been if they had lived hundreds of years earlier, because no one would know. For example, if it was people like David or Jeremiah or Isaiah, no one would know that it was them because no one had ever seen them alive. And they didn't have photographs back then. So I think that I think it's probably not a case of glorification of their bodies as we would have in the resurrection.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Vince, thanks for your call. God bless you. Now, Barbara from Eugene, I'm afraid I only have about 60 seconds. If that's too short, just say so. Or if you just want to make some short comment, feel free. Welcome.
Okay, thanks so much. I just had a question. We were told we should not say Scripture is not inerrant. And I thought, wow, you know, it would be different to say that different people recorded their experiences differently, you know, what they saw. But I don't call those errors in the Bible. And according to Timothy, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered what your opinion would be on that term.
Yeah. Well, first of all, inspiration of God in Greek means it's God-breathed. Exactly what that looks like or feels like when the guy's writing the Scripture and having God breathe it to him, I don't know. The word inerrant is not actually used in the Bible, but it is used by evangelicals to describe their belief that the way that God inspired the writers made them incapable of recording any errors. I agree with you that virtually everything that people call a contradiction in the Bible really isn't. In almost every case, it's simply someone telling the story a little differently, not in a way that contradicts others necessarily, but in a way that includes different details and different nuance or different angle. And we do that all the time. Two witnesses in a court of law can tell the same event, and they won't give the same details. That's not a problem. In fact, it'd be a problem if they did give all the same details, because that would mean they had colluded. I don't think that we have contradictions in the Bible of that kind, and I'm with you on that. As far as the inerrancy of Scripture, that's an interesting concept to look into, or we don't have time to go into it in detail now. Maybe we will in a future program. I appreciate your call, though, Barbara. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported program, and this year, as well as previous years, we need support from people like you if we're going to stay on the air. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Hope we can talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Bye now.